Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And of course, the Michael Flynn guilty plea has to do with lying to the FBI about discussing sanctions on Russia with the Russians. Sanctions in the news. Then news came over the weekend that the Iran deal may be set to unravel as President Trump recently decided to decertify the deal, with reports that the U.S. Congress is expected to make a decision on whether Washington will pull out of the landmark international accord altogether as early as this week. Joining me now to discuss the implications of both, as well as how sanctions could work to denuclearize North Korea or not, and sanctions in general, is Richard Nephew. He was the lead sanctions expert for the U.S. team negotiating with Iran from August 2013 to December 2014. He is now senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, and the author of a new book called The Art of Sanctions, A View from the Field. Welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with Flynn.
Yeah.
Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, for anybody who's been under a rock, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI when he said that he did not discuss sanctions with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. Can you remind us of what the Obama administration sanctions were and how they were supposed to punish Russia for meddling in the election?
Sure. Basically, the United States imposed an asset freeze and prohibition on doing business in the United States for the Russian intelligence services, as well as a number of specific individuals. We seized two properties that were diplomatic compounds used by the embassy, and in our view, used for espionage. And basically, we attempted to put a big shining light on what the Russians had been doing in the election.
And court documents on Friday, along with Flynn's plea, showed that he told the ambassador on December 29th of last year, the same day as the Obama sanctions were officially imposed, that Russia should not retaliate in response to the sanctions. And in a subsequent call, Mr. Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, told Flynn that, quote, Russia had chosen to moderate its response to those sanctions as a result of his request. How unusual is that?
That's pretty unusual, and not really the thing you want to have done when you're imposing sanctions. Part of the whole point is to try and demonstrate to your adversary that you're very upset and that you want them to stop doing the things that they were doing. And to come out the day of and say, don't worry about these things, the new guy will be in town soon, that's a pretty disturbing signal.
So let's go to the general concept here, because you write in your book that sanctions are not about catching the enemy or trapping it. A trapped enemy has no options and few ways of satisfying its adversaries to a mutually satisfactory degree. So in that sense, what good, and we'll get into a number of examples, what good sanctions do anywhere at any time, what good do you think they have done with respect to changing Russia's behavior or could do?
Well, I think in terms of behavior with regarding the elections, I think they put a spotlight for a lot of other countries that were going to have elections as to what the Russians were up to. And they made it much harder for the Russians to engage in the same sort of activities in Europe and other places. I think they also served to push back on what the Russians had been up to here and to demonstrate that in the future, we're going to respond accordingly. And the whole purpose of this is to stop the Russians from engaging in those activities in the future. That's the whole point. And success in this regard will be judged by an election happening in maybe 10 months' time in which we don't have any indications of Russian malfeasance.
On to the Iran deal, which you were involved in negotiating. Actually, you want to tell us a little bit about your role in that so people know?
Sure. So as almost my penance for having imposed sanctions against the Iranians for a good 10 years prior to negotiations, I was asked to join both the secret talks in Oman and then the public talks in Vienna and other places with the Iranians to try and put restraints on their nuclear program. The negotiations started in August of 2013 and then concluded with an agreement in July July of 2015. And my job, because I had both done sanctions work as well as nuclear nonproliferation work, was to try and present a package of what the Iranians needed to do on nuclear grounds in order to get what kind of sanctions relief.
Now, the Iran deal is formally known as the JCPOA, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and it's between Iran, six world powers, U.S., U.K., Russia, France, China, and Germany, and the EU. And the deal basically was that if Iran froze its nuclear program for a number of years, sanctions that were in place would come off. So those sanctions must have been effective because Iran had an incentive to trade something away in order to be rid of them, would you say?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that. And I would say the fact that the deal also required Iran to get rid of certain nuclear facilities, including a reactor that could have produced weapons-grade plutonium, to me underscores the degree to which sanctions actually had to change their behavior. And for about 10 years, they resisted any kind of abridgment of their nuclear rights or expanded international access to their facilities. And that changed in July of 2013 when the sanctions were really punishing their economy.
So what's the difference between sanctions on Iran, excuse me, with respect to a nuclear program that seemed to work, and the sanctions on North Korea that seem never to work? In fact, every time they launch a missile, it seems like the world is imposing more sanctions. And I, as a layperson, sit here and think, God, what more haven't we already sanctioned? You know, how can we keep laying more and more sanctions? What are all these sanctions? What's left to sanction? And has it ever done any good?
Yeah, that is the common experience is that, you know, gee, North Korea has got to be the most sanctioned country on earth. That's actually not the case. Iran, in many respects, was subject to more sanctions than North Korea was, in part because our sanctions went beyond U.S. borders, and they targeted any kind of business activity with the Iranians. And we were successful because there was a lot of countries that had business activities with the Iranians. With North Korea, one of the big differences that the major trading partner and business partner of North Korea is China. And so if you want to take aim at North Korean finances, really you have to target Chinese banks and Chinese institutions. And for obvious domestic reasons, that's been seen as unattractive for the United States.
Is the deal salvageable with the other signatories if the United States pulls out? What happens if, you know, I just mentioned all the different parties that signed on the one side with Iran on the other side, the U.S., the U.K., Russia, France, China, Germany, and the EU as an organization. So if Trump announces and Congress goes along with this week, ending our participation in it, what happens?
Yeah, I think it'd be very difficult to salvage it. And it's not because these other countries don't have their own roles and relationships with Iran. It's the nature of our sanctions, which were intended to preclude foreign business activity with Iran. If we reactivate all of those, then every energy company in China and Europe and Asia has to make a decision. Do we do business with the United States or do we do business with Iran? And to the extent that they make the same choices they did last time, they're going to choose the United States, which basically means the Iranians no longer get the economic benefits they had paid for with nuclear concessions. Really, the only chance for salvaging it is if Europe and Asia countries are willing to challenge the United States and willing to tell the United States, our companies will not go along with you.
My guest is Richard Nephew. He was the lead sanctions expert for the U.S. team negotiating with Iran in 2013 and 2014. Before that, nuclear arms deal for lifting sanctions agreement was reached, and he has a new book called The Art of Sanctions, A View from the Field, and we can take your phone call for him, phone calls, at 212-433-WNYC on sanctions, 212-433-9692. I think for a lot of people, especially people of a certain age, you say sanctions, the first thing they're going to think of is South Africa. Where does that fit in the pantheon of sanctions, effective or ineffective?
I think it's pretty high up on the list of effective sanctions, and it's because it met a number of the criterion that I lay out in my book. It had very clear objectives, ending the apartheid regime and its discrimination against the majority population of South Africa. It had a lot of international support. Beyond just state support, it had a lot of grassroots support. So you had a lot of pressure coming at the South Africans from a number of different directions. And in the end, it was successful because it was able to communicate to the South African government, you have to make some major changes here or the economy of the country is going to collapse. And so from that perspective, I think it ranks pretty high on the list.
You explained the objective of sanctions in general by using a metaphor about designing a maze. Tell us more.
Yeah, so my theory of all this is, and it goes to the question of, are we trying to trap somebody here? What sanctions are intended to do is to lay out a path that we want the target to follow. We want them to get to the end of that path. And at the end of that path is supposed to be a different policy, whether it's nuclear proliferation, human rights, terrorism, or so forth. But what we're trying to do is trying to convince them along the way by giving them little pokes and prods or maybe laying out the maze a certain way that if they follow the path, there will be a reward at the end. They'll get the cheese. But if they don't follow that path, only more problems are going to be presented to them.
Let's take a phone call. Dimitri in Newark. You're on WNYC. Hello, Dimitri.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Nephew. How are you guys doing?
All right.
So my question is that if, for example, the U.S. were to pull out from the Iran agreement, could other countries decide not to follow along in the sense by that they are not going to stop doing business with Iran and also they want to do business with America by threatening to sanction U.S. companies in retaliation if the U.S. was to sanction their companies that do business with Iran? Is this something that those countries, for example, the European Union countries and other Asian countries could do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the history of this, if you go back to 1997, the EU already has a law on the books that would permit retaliation against U.S. companies and U.S. interests if European companies and European interests were to be damaged through the use of U.S. sanctions. Now, in a deal that was cut between the Clinton administration and European governments in 97, we avoided that kind of problem over Cuba, Iran, and Libya sanctions at the time. But that law is still on the books. And if the Europeans are sufficiently upset, they can trigger it.
All right, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll continue in a minute with Richard Nephew, who is a lead sanctions expert in the Iran nuclear talks and is now the author of The Art of Sanctions, A View from the Field. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Richard Nephew, late of the State Department, sanctions expert who helped negotiate the Iran arms deal, and now the author of The Art of Sanctions, A View from the Field. So from the previous sanctions imposed on North Korea, from the view of those, and they're still doing what they're doing, what's left for the United States to do?
Well, I think there is more the U.S. could do by targeting Chinese banks and targeting a lot of the business interests that China has with North Korea. But we have to come back to a more fundamental question of to what end? Do we think that imposing a bunch of sanctions on Chinese banks is going to make North Korea stop having nuclear weapons and stop testing intercontinental ballistic missiles? In my view, the answer to that is no. And it's one of the reasons why in the book, I note out my concern with the fact that we're not following an objective-based format. We're not thinking about what we're trying to achieve and then setting out to achieve it. Instead, we're just sort of throwing more sanctions on the fire. And I think we need to reevaluate what is our end state here, what are our end goals, and avoid just taking sanctions actions that feel good or may look like they're being aggressive and assertive, but in the end, don't do a whole lot.
Chadney in Bayside, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. So my question is, with every bit of politics, and especially in this red team versus blue team era that we live in right now, what is the U.S. having to give up or to use as a compromise to get other countries to kind of coerce them into providing sanctions against countries we want them to provide sanctions against?
Yeah, what we've done to date is basically use the U.S. economy itself as the quid pro quo. And so we create leverage. We don't have to trade anything other than the status quo. If you want to do business in the United States, if you want to continue doing business in the United States, then you have to undertake the kinds of sanctions compliance steps that we would demand. But it's a great question because it points to a broader issue. how much longer is that value going to be there? How much longer is the U.S. going to be able to create value by leveraging the U.S. economy? Is there a chance at some point in the future that we won't be able to do that, that other people will call our bets, or that our economy will not be so dominant as to give us this magic amount of additional leverage?
Chuck in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how you doing? My question is, what does Trump want to achieve by decertifying here? What would look like a good result for him, or for this administration in general? You know, where are we going with this that they want to see?
Yeah, this is my concern, too. I think they've stated a couple of different rationale, and it's not clear to me at all that you can achieve any of them, and much less all of them at once. What the administration has said is they want to get a stronger set of nuclear constraints on Iran that potentially go for much, much longer than the 10 to 20 years that we presently have, maybe 20, 30 years, 40 years. And also that we would be able to apply pressure on Iran to no longer support groups like Hezbollah, other terrorist groups engaged in Syria and Yemen, as well as violations of human rights. So basically, they put on the table a lot. And what's not at all clear to me is, do we have a sense of bottom lines? If we got X amount more from Europe and from Asia, would that be good enough to continue going along with the nuclear agreement? Much less whether or not the Iranians would ever accept any of those sorts of things.
I'm thinking about one instance of sanctions, the sanctions that the U.S. used to impose on Iraq between the two Iraq wars, after the Gulf War in 1991 until after 9/11, the Iraq War in 2003, there were sanctions. And a big debate at that time by people pushing against the sanctions was that it was hurting the people,
right,
that Iraqi children were dying of starvation, all kinds of other things, horrible effects were alleged from the U.S. sanctions, with, you know, the bottom line of that being the sanctions were hurting the people. They weren't hurting Saddam Hussein and forcing him out of power. How much of a consideration is that in sanctions? And can sanctions be designed to harm the offending regime without hurting the population of innocent people?
Yeah, it's a major consideration of sanctions ever since Iraq. It wasn't just the humanitarian community that thought a lot about the Iraq example. It was sanctions experts as well. And no one in the U.S. government in particular wanted to see new Iran sanctions, for instance, starving Iranian children and having the same kind of impacts, not least because it's not clear that that would have any positive impact in terms of actually delivering real changes in policy. So we thought a lot about how to make sanctions much more targeted and how to focus the impact on identified bad guys, you know, by going after their assets, by going after their ability to travel. The problem is that at some point or other, if you're going after a really big fish and a really big target, the pain threshold is obviously much larger, and you need to put a lot more on the table. So we haven't yet figured out how to solve that problem, but it's something that's definitely a conscious part of the decision-making.
On going after the big fish and trying to hurt them personally, isn't that exactly what the Magnitsky Act is supposed to be? That thing that Putin seems so bent on trying to get rid of, that's what that secret June meeting with people from the Trump campaign last year was aimed at trying to get the U.S. to undo out of all the things that Russia might have asked for?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because the Magnitsky Act, like other very targeted sanctions, it affects access to U.S. banks, but also affects access to all sorts of banks around the world. And if you're talking about big fish who have got a lot of money and they like going to places like London and Paris and spending some of that money, it makes it a lot more difficult for them to do any of that if they're on the U.S. Treasury Department's list. So certainly for individuals, some of these very specific sanctions can be devastating. And I recall an example in Iran where we bankrupted a guy who was engaged in sanctions evasion out of Greece. It had the effect of stopping him from doing that again. But when it comes to countries, that's a much more difficult sort of equation to run.
Pilo in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes. Hello. My name is Pilo. I actually work for the Security Council Affairs Division of the UN, and I was wondering what the your guest assessment is on the DPRK panel of experts, which has been appointed by the Council and reporting to the council, to the committee. Like, they basically make recommendations. They look into specifically the dual-use goods, how do they get the nuclear fuel and all of that. What sort of your assessment, how effective these reports have been in kind of raising more awareness and telling the council how to target more specifically individuals, companies, and such things?
Yeah, I think they're very important. They provide a objective set of data that governments around the world can use, especially because the participation is usually a wide cross-section of interested countries. It's not just American and European governments providing intelligence, but you've also got Russian and Chinese officials who are involved in it as well. So I think they provide...
And by the way, just to decode, I think he said DPRK, that's North Korea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even all the panels, though, provide this very effective set of objective facts you can use both for targeting as well as for explaining to governments. Maybe you don't think that you're as bad at implementation as you are, but you are. And you've got real problems that need to be fixed through legislation or through enforcement efforts. So the UN panels are a vital part of the sanctions system.
Can you give me a thought as a former State Department official on what's going on there? Tillerson rumored to be out the door soon in favor of the current CIA director, Mike Pompeo, and 153 State Departments that are nominated by a president. Of those, half are unfilled. How does it look to you as a former State Department sanctions expert?
Well, it's very bleak. I think what's happened in this administration should alarm people transcending partisan boundaries here. The State Department exists to serve a number of very important functions. It's not simply diplomats eating tiny sandwiches in conference rooms and coffee houses. And so the kinds of officials that are not working right now include people responsible for arms control, people responsible for sanctions, people responsible for vital regions like in East Asia and the Pacific. And so at the moment, it really looks like the State Department's being hollowed out in a way that is going to compromise it not only now, but into the future.
We will have to leave it there for today. My guest has been Richard Nephew, senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, and the author of The Art of Sanctions, A View from the Field. He will be having a launch event for this book tomorrow, Tuesday, December 5th. From 6 to 8 p.m. at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia. That's 420 West 118th Street. More information is on our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.